Check. Filth? Check. Anger? Check. A crazy lady threatening my life? Check. And a hefty bill at the end? Check. As any landlord reading this can testify, evictions are not fun. They are messy, stressful, time-intensive, and expensive. During this period of time, many landlords begin to question why they are even in this game to begin with. And this is why targeting landlords who are in the midst of an eviction can be so powerful. They have a problem, and there's a great chance they'll be motivated to get rid of property as fast as possible. Had someone talked to me while I was going through my first eviction, I would have seriously considered unloading the property right then and there. So how can you target landlords who are going through an eviction? Well, public records. That's right. Evictions are part of the public records in most counties in America. In other words, you can take a trip to your local county administration office and ask to see a list of the current evictions. Different counties and states do evictions a little differently, so I can't tell you exactly how to track down the list in your area. But if you ask around enough, it shouldn't be hard to find. Then make some phone calls or start sending some letters. Number 5, the Bigger Pockets Marketplace. What if there was a single source online where real estate investors could come together to buy and sell their properties? Well, what a coincidence. There just happens to be such a place, and we call it the Bigger Pockets Marketplace. Every day, dozens of listings are posted and real transactions happen as a result. You can post an ad for either something you want or something you have. Are you looking for a certain kind of property in a certain area? Make a post. Are you looking to sell one of your properties? Make a post. Are you looking to partner with someone? Make a post. The beauty of the marketplace is its connection to the keyword alerts on Bigger Pockets that we talked a little bit about in Chapter 2. You'll never know who is looking to sell you a deal in your area, so why not post an ad today? Number 6, Craigslist. In the good old days, people used the newspaper to place classified ads. Although the newspaper might still be an effective tool in some areas, a new business has emerged that is quickly putting newspaper classifieds out of business, Craigslist. Craigslist is an online classified section where it is free to post and free to browse, so it makes a great resource for finding real estate deals. There are 3 strategies I want to share for using Craigslist. Number 1, search for sellers. Perhaps the easiest and most passive way to use Craigslist is to simply search the site for real estate postings in your area. You can do this fairly easily and can even automate the process so that new posts that contain certain keywords you choose are sent directly to your email inbox. You can do that through a site called If This Then That or ifttt.com. The problem with this strategy is that there are a lot of folks doing this. So if you want to get really creative, you need to go on the offensive, which brings me to my next tip. Post an ad. Why wait for the deals to come to you? Instead, post an ad that says you are looking for a house to buy. Make it big and make it flashy and get people's attention right there on Craigslist. Number 3, search for landlords. Perhaps my favorite use of Craigslist is actually in contacting landlords who are posting on Craigslist. Landlording is not easy, and as I often say, 90% of the landlords out there suck. Many landlords lose money year after year and are only hanging onto their property because they know it would be hard to sell it without first fixing it up. Therefore, you can use Craigslist to search for rental listings that appear to have been placed by mom-and-pop landlords, probably not professional property management companies. Most likely, the landlord put their phone number directly in the post, so give them a call. Explain that you were looking to invest in real estate in their area, and you saw their post, and although you are interested in renting it, you might be interested in buying the property. Even if they don't want to sell that particular property, there is a chance they will have something else they do want to sell, or they know someone else who does. Worst case scenario, you build a relationship with a local investor. Maybe you even gain a free mentor out of the deal. Craigslist truly is a no-brainer when you are on the hunt for a good deal. Not only is it free, but it's also where people go to buy and sell things. So why not take 5 minutes today and go find a great deal on Craigslist? Number 7, wholesalers. How great would it be if you could sit at home while someone else was out there pounding the pavement looking to bring you a killer deal? Well, that is exactly what could happen if you get your deals from a wholesaler. Wholesaling is a business of finding incredible real estate deals, usually through the methods we've already talked about, putting those deals under contract, and then selling or assigning that contract to another investor for a slightly higher amount. Some wholesalers will actually buy the property for 5 or 10 minutes and then resell it to you right away. For example, a wholesaler might find a deal and put it under contract for $110,000 and then sell that deal to you for $115,000, netting them a nice $5,000 profit for him or herself and helping you to get a great deal. The key to working with wholesalers is this. You have to find a good one. This is actually a lot trickier than it sounds because, trust me, there are a lot of wannabe wholesalers out there who claim to know what they're doing, but they really don't. Wholesaling is one of the most difficult real estate jobs because you have to be great at almost every aspect of the transaction. Marketing, analyzing, communication, sales, negotiation, etc. Nevertheless, the approach of wholesaling is consistently taught by real estate gurus as a get-rich-quickly way to build wealth with real estate. However, if you are able to connect with a great wholesaler, you truly can get hot deals delivered straight to your inbox. To find wholesalers, I recommend the following. Call the numbers you see on those ugly bandit signs on the side of the road. Go to every real estate club in your area. Create a marketplace posting on BiggerPockets. Or train your own wholesaler on how to find deals. Number 8. Finally, the last method to find great deals is what I call passion. And this is hard to describe exactly, but here's the gist. People want to help you achieve your goals. Once you let the world know what you want, other people will help you get it. Let me tell you a quick story. When I was 24 years old, I had just finished reading Ken McElroy's book, The ABCs of Real Estate Investing. And I quickly fell in love with the concept of investing in apartment complexes. At church the next morning, I mentioned my newfound love of apartment investing to a nice older couple who then told me that they actually had an apartment complex that they were looking to sell. Now, was that luck or was it something I did? Well, I think it was both. As the saying goes, the harder I work, the luckier I get. I didn't just tell one couple about my goals. I told everybody I knew because I was so passionate about it. This is the concept of finding deals through passion. Let your goals and your passion be heard and amazing things can happen. Conclusion. As real estate grows in popularity, you have two choices. Sit out and wait until the next crash, or do what needs to be done to find a deal. I know what option I'll be taking. Do you? Now that you have some good ideas for finding properties, let's talk about the process for determining whether a deal is actually worth buying. Chapter 10. Which properties make the best rentals? Jim Halpert. Question. What kind of bear is best? Dwight. That's a ridiculous question. Jim. False. Black bear. NBC's The Office. In 2006, NASA admitted that it had accidentally taped over the original recording of the first lunar landing. In 1962, Decca Records had a choice to sign one of two bands. They chose Brian Poole and the Tremolos. Which band did they reject? The Beatles. In 1788, the Austrian army accidentally attacked itself and lost 10,000 men. Clearly, mistakes happen. The same will be true for your real estate business, though hopefully to a lesser extent than the examples above. But one mistake that can be fatal to your real estate business is choosing the wrong property. Picking the wrong property is a lot like picking the wrong spouse. It can be incredibly stressful, expensive to get out of, and detrimental to your well-being. But how do you know what the right property is? After all, there are a lot of properties out there. What should you buy? What should you avoid? Are four bedrooms better or worse than two bedrooms? What about garages, neighbors? These are important questions you should be asking if you want to buy the right deal and have the most success as a landlord. So let's examine several things I look for when shopping for a rental property. Keep in mind, as with all things in this book, all of this depends heavily on the trends in your location. Furthermore, the following list is not a bunch of rules you must follow, but rather just some pieces of wisdom that I've picked up and have served me well. Bedrooms. It's hard to get long-term tenants in a one- or two-bedroom house. Tenants who are single tend to choose a one-bedroom but quickly hook up with that cute guy or girl from work and then they need a larger place. They move into a two-bedroom and soon start having kids again and finally need more space. Therefore, in my experience, three- or four-bedroom houses tend to make the best rentals for houses because they attract long-term tenants, which cuts down your vacancy expenses. Furthermore, three-bedroom houses are generally the best kind of property to sell, which can be great when that time comes. If you are looking for a multifamily property, two-bedroom apartments are usually acceptable and incredibly common. Single-bedroom and studio apartments are also common, but they tend to attract a more transient tenant, so expect more turnover in that style. Also understand that having more bedrooms is not always better. Once you get into 5-bedroom homes or higher, you'll find that the only tenant willing to rent them are families with a lot of kids. Now, I like kids as much as the next person, but I would never discriminate against them because that's illegal. But the truth is, having a lot of kids is hard on a property. Broken windows, stained carpet, etc. Keeping a house to 3 bedrooms, maybe 4, is the best way to keep the kid count down legally. Age. The older the property is, the more expensive it's going to be to fix. I invest in a lot of older homes because they offer the best price in my market. But I definitely pay dearly for my choice. Projects that seem to be fairly simple have a tendency to get out of hand quickly, as existing but previously unknown problems are discovered. You have to deal with the work that others who are far less skilled have done over the years and live with the consequences of past shoddy work. Older homes are also generally less energy efficient than newer homes, which can cause the utility bills to be much higher. You might not think that matters much if the tenant will pay for their own heating or cooling, but trust me, tenants know. If your property costs an extra $100 to heat or cool, your tenant will do the math, and you may have a more difficult time keeping the property rented long term. Again, I'm not telling that you should not invest in older homes. Just understand that a newer property is, generally the fewer issues you'll have to deal with, maintenance-wise. Garage. When you are investing in a single-family house, you may have difficulty finding a stable, long-term tenant for a house without a garage. Tenants tend to accumulate a lot of stuff, and they need the place to store it. Plus, in areas that get a fair amount of snow or rain, tenants like the luxury of being able to park in a garage. I've generally found that the homes I own that have garages stay rented far longer than those that do not. Utilities. Some properties, especially older ones, have all the utilities paid by the owner, which is not really ideal. Buy these kind of properties only if the numbers truly make sense, because having so little control over this major expense will give you a major headache. When tenants don't need to pay for their own heat, they tend to leave windows open in the winter or the AC running 24/7 in the summer. If they don't need to pay for water, they'll never let you know about the constant drip in the bathroom, thereby costing you hundreds or maybe thousands of dollars per year. When looking for single-family homes, look for ones for which all utilities, including water, sewer, garbage, electricity, and heat, can be paid directly by the tenant. Now, when shopping for multifamily, at least look for the ones where heat and electricity can be paid by the tenant. And if you can find properties that can be converted to a master metered system to allow tenants to pay for their own water, you potentially struck gold. Lawn care. Properties with large lawns, gardens, and other outside features will never be taken care of by tenants the way that you or I might take care of them. Although there are exceptions to every rule, I tend to look for properties that have smaller yards to keep the yard work for the tenant at a minimum. That said, recreational space is very important in attracting a stable, long-term tenant. So make sure there is somewhere the tenant and or their kids can run around and have fun. Parking. Stable tenants need a place to park their vehicles. Off-street parking, a driveway, carport, a garage, is something nearly all great tenants prefer, so look for properties with this feature. And generally, 2 parking spots are better than 1, 3 are better than 2, and so on. Location. I talked about location a lot already in the previous chapter, so I don't need to belabor the point. However, when shopping for a property, keep an eye out for what is nearby. A tenant is just like you. They want to eat out occasionally, take a jog in a park, pick up a gallon of milk from the grocery store. Buy in locations where tenants want to live, and you'll find a more stable rental. These are just a few of the property characteristics I look for when buying a property. You don't need to get each and every one in perfect to get a great rental property, but these factors are important to consider when shopping. Now, this might surprise you, but I actually don't like to buy perfect properties. The fact is that perfect properties come at a premium. A savvy investor is always looking to snag a great deal, which is why I tend to avoid perfect properties. And instead, I look for problem properties. Let me explain. 8 problems I look for when shopping for rental properties. Yes, you heard that correctly. When looking for a rental property, I actually proactively look for problems. Sure, it is entirely possible to buy a rental property that is 100% finished and great. And perhaps for you and your business model, that is what you should do. But for me, I want to find problems that I can fix that will help me get a better deal. So how do problems get me a better deal? Well, it's simple. When most people encounter the following 8 problems, they turn around and walk out the door, repulsed and saying, no way. I walk into that same property, take a look around, and start to get excited. In fact, it is hard for me to be excited about a property that doesn't have problems. It is the fear of dealing with problems that drives most people away, and with less competition, I know I can find better deal. Before I get to the list, I want to caution you with this. With problems comes risk. It is imperative that you understand the full nature of the problem at hand and that you include an accurate budget to fix that problem when doing your numbers. Whether you're using a spreadsheet you created or the BiggerPockets rental property calculator, just be sure to include the accurate amount to cover each problem. If you are unsure how to properly estimate repair costs, I estimate picking up a copy of Jay Scott's excellent book, The Book on Estimating Rehab Costs, The Investor's Guide to Defining Your Renovation Plan, Building Your Budget, and Knowing Exactly How Much It Costs, which you can find on Amazon.com or BiggerPockets.com/flippingbook. So with that, let's get to the 8 problems. Number 1, the Bigfoot smell. When you walk into a house and it smells like Bigfoot died in the kitchen, is your first thought, I gotta get out of here? The truth is, most people respond with disgust, but seasoned investors see opportunity. Bad smells are one of the easiest problems to fix on a property, but one of the things that drive away 99% of the competition. Bad smells are generally caused by one or more of the following things, none of which are real difficult to solve. Rotten food in the cupboards or rubbed into the carpet. Cat or dog urine soaked into the floor. Smoke residue on the walls, ceiling, and floors. Mildew on the windows, walls, or other surfaces. Or Bigfoot dead in the kitchen. As long as you are not dealing with some kind of environmental issue or a major sewer leak under the house, you'll likely find smells are fairly easy to eliminate and with some cleaning. To get rid of the smell, go through the following list in order and stop when the smell is gone. Number 1, carpet. In my experience, getting rid of the carpet and the pad underneath will get rid of 90% of the problem immediately. So plan on hiring a couple people for a few hours to remove the smelly carpet. For under $100, most of your problems will be solved. Open all the windows and let the property air out for a few hours. Number 2, mop. Mop the floor with a mixture of bleach and water. Let it dry and open the windows to air the place out. It can take a day or two for the smell of bleach to disappear and let you know if the smell is truly gone. Number 3, clean. Make sure every crumb in the kitchen is picked up and all windows have been washed. Obviously, you will need to do this anyway, so find a professional cleaner who can come in and clean every square inch. Number 4, prime the floors. If the smell persists, buy some cans of Kiehl's oil-based primer and a long-handled paint roller from the local hardware store. Pour the primer out all onto the floor. It's actually a lot of fun, really. And spread it out over every square inch. I will warn you, oil-based primer is strong smelling, so be sure to use a respirator. They run about $30, so you don't pass out. I'm not kidding. You will pass out otherwise. I've been there and done that. The chemicals are just too potent. Number 5, wash the walls. This approach is most commonly used when dealing with stale smoke smell. Get a good sponge and a bucket of soapy water and scrub the walls. Often, you'll be able to physically watch the smoke residue just wipe away from the walls, which is an oddly satisfying experience. Number 6, prime and paint the walls and the ceiling. Lastly, and for situations where the other approaches have not solved the problem, hire someone to spray the entire inside of the house with that Kiehl's oil-based primer. About $200 in primer will do a whole house, plus a couple days of labor. Following these steps, I've never had a problem smell I could not eliminate. Whether you do the task yourself or hire a local handyman to do it for you, the entire process is unlikely to cost more than about $1,000, not including, of course, the cost of new carpet, which you're likely planning to replace anyway. And at the end, you'll have a fresh, clean, and newly painted property ready for a new tenant. The great news is that a bad smell can drive the cost of a home down considerably, maybe tens of thousands of dollars. So now you understand why investors often say, smells like money. One final caveat on the smell issue, make sure the smell is not coming from a busted sewer line under the property or in the basement or something tragic like that. That fix could be much more expensive. If you are unsure what is causing the bad smell in a property, bring along someone with more experience and or be sure to get a professional home inspection on the property. Number 2, the hidden third bedroom. I mentioned earlier that I don't like two-bedroom homes for a rental property. However, there is one case where I get very excited about buying a two-bedroom home, where there is a hidden third bedroom. No, I'm not talking about some mysterious bedroom hidden behind a wall, though admittedly that would be really cool. I'm talking about taking a room where it is not considered a bedroom and turning it into one. For example, the other day I checked out a house that had two bedrooms, one bathroom, a laundry room, and a large storage room next to the laundry room. The storage room was 10 foot by 12 foot, the perfect size for a bedroom. The walls were finished, the floor just needed carpet, and a door would need to be added. In addition, to make it a legal bedroom, I would need to build a small closet in the corner. In other words, to turn this two-bedroom home into a three-bedroom home, I was looking at maybe $3,000 of labor and materials. As a two-bedroom, the property was worth about $90,000. However, as a three-bedroom home, that same house was worth probably $115,000. In many cases, the difference in house values between a two-bedroom and a three-bedroom can be significantly higher than the cost of converting a hidden bedroom into a functional legal bedroom. This helps build some immediate equity in the property, since you're paying for a two-bedroom, but will own a three-bedroom. In case you are wondering, the jump from three-bedroom to four-bedroom is likely not the same as from two to three, so I usually just stick to the latter. Of course, not all two-bedroom homes have this hidden bedroom. Most don't. But I found that roughly 20% of two-bedroom properties do have some potential for a third bedroom. Keep an eye out for this kind of property and look for keywords like bonus room, attic, and huge bedroom, which can often be split in two. Number three, ugly countertops and cabinets. You've likely heard the phrase, kitchens and baths sell houses, and it is no exaggeration. People spend a large amount of time in the kitchen, and nothing says 1979 like bright orange countertops or ugly cabinets. Most people simply avoid houses with these problems. Those people don't realize how easy it can be to transform an ugly kitchen into a modern, beautiful one with just some new counters and a fresh coat of paint on the cabinets. Yes, that's right. Many times you can paint old cabinets to make them look brand new. Rust-Oleum sells a really nice cabinet refinishing kit for under $100 at Home Depot that'll turn nasty cabinets into modern works of art. See figure 10 at biggerpockets.com/rentalbookfigures for a picture of one of my recent transformations. In this property, I didn't even have to replace the countertops. I simply painted the cabinets, installed new hardware, and added a tile backsplash and some new flooring. Furthermore, replacing countertops is a fairly straightforward process. You can pick up prefabricated laminate countertops from Home Depot or Lowe's for a couple $100 and have it installed in a couple hours. Or you can spring for a nicer granite or quartz if the neighborhood style demands it. All in all, don't be scared by 1979. It is entirely possible to turn a dated, ugly kitchen into a gorgeous one for under $1,000, so look for easy wins like that to snag a great deal. Number four, the bad roof. This one might come as a bit of a shock to people because a leaking roof seems like it would be a pretty major problem. However, I like finding properties that are in desperate need of a new roof because it scares off a lot of the competition, and getting a new roof is really not that difficult of a process. Sure, it can be a little expensive, but I usually get the current roof removed and a new one put on for under $6,000, and it's completed in a day or two. Now, I don't need to worry about the roof leaking on my rental property for many, many years, and I can just factor that new roof into my budget. Now, keep in mind, roofing costs can vary wildly depending on the contractor you consult. In my area, the two largest contractors will typically charge between $15,000 and $20,000 to replace a roof. And because they are the largest roofing contractors in my area, most people call both to get bids from both, only to find that the bids are within a few $100s of each other. Little do they know, of course, that the companies are actually owned by the same person. So of course the bids come in the same. If they took time to call a few more contractors, they discovered that the cost of a roof is actually less than $6,000 from nearly everyone else in town. Same material, same quality, but drastically different prices. So keep that in mind when shopping for your next roof. Don't get taken advantage of. Shop around, ask for referrals, and then check up on those referrals. But don't let a bad roof overwhelm you. Instead, look at the opportunity. Number five, mold. Uh-oh, did I just say the M word? Yep. And yes, mold is one of the best problems I look for when buying a property. You see, mold is a scary, scary thing to the average consumer, maybe even to you. But it shouldn't be. You see, mold is a fungus that grows naturally everywhere. It is in your house right now. It's in your car. It's probably in your beard and in your hair. It's in the air you breathe all the time if you live in a wet climate, especially. Are you still scared? Mold is everywhere that there's moisture. However, when mold spores begin to settle and accumulate in large quantities, suddenly the human eye can detect the mold and will start to see spots of black or green on certain surfaces. Now, if there is enough mold in an area, it can be dangerous to people with certain immune system problems, but in small quantities, it's not like anthrax, as much as the U.S. population seems to think so. But let's just keep them thinking that mold is just slightly worse than eating a spoonful of ricin, And while they're out there complaining about the few spots of mold on a property, I'm out there investigating why there is mold and snatching up amazing deals. Mold is not a random occurrence that happens for a reason. That reason is moisture. Eliminate the moisture and you eliminate the visible mold. If you walk into a potential rental property and there is mold all over the bathroom walls, and then you notice that there is no window or a vent in the bathroom, well, guess what? That's right. The mold is growing because the moisture from the shower can't leave the bathroom. Install a vent and the problem is probably solved. Mold all over the ceiling? I would wager that there is either a roof leak or no ceiling insulation directly above the moldy spot. So condensation in the room is forming on the cold spot where the insulation is missing, causing moldy growth. The only mold I would really, really worry about is the mold in basement walls because it indicates water seeping in through the foundation, and that begins to scare me. Fixing a bad, leaking foundation can be incredibly complicated and expensive. So unless you are a more experienced investor, I would steer clear of those issues. Number 6, compartmentalized configuration. I think this might be the longest word in the entire book, but the concept is not hard to understand. Compartmentalization is a characteristic found in many homes, especially older properties where the rooms were designed to be separate from one another. Today, there's a movement towards the open concept living, in which the living room, dining room, and kitchen have no clear borders and they all kind of blend together. People want to cook in the kitchen while still engaging with the rest of the family in the living room or dining room. But properties that are severely compartmentalized do not allow for this and are therefore not as desirable to the average homeowner. As with the rest of the items on this list, anything that drives away the general population makes me take interest. Compartmentalization is a problem that intrigues me for two different reasons. First, in a rental property, compartmentalization is not always a problem, so you can pick up a house for less than other similar homes, but it might not rent for any less. Secondly, compartmentalized properties can be opened up fairly easy to modernize them. Usually for under a couple $1,000, a contractor can go in and tear out a wall or open the property up in another way, increasing the desirability and thus its value. Figure 11 at biggerpockets.com/rentalbookfigures shows how I recently opened up a compartmentalized kitchen into a spacious open concept by simply removing one wall that divided the dining room and the kitchen. Jungle landscaping. You've likely heard the term curb appeal before and probably know the importance of having a property look pristine from the street. After all, the landscaping is the very first thing potential buyers see when they visit a property. This is why I love to find properties where the yard looks less like a yard and more like Tarzan's jungle. Long grass, dead grass, overgrown bushes, pink flamingos, it's all good. Landscaping is not a terribly difficult or expensive thing to clean up, but the bad condition can drive away the bulk of the competition, helping you snag a great deal. It is amazing what a simple cleaning, mowing, and edging can do to a property, and typically, for less than $1,000, a problematic landscape situation can become a nice yard. Number 8, junk, junk, and more junk. Have you ever watched the television show Hoarders? This show takes you inside the home of individuals who have a compulsive habit of saving or collecting an absurd amount of junk. Sometimes the house is filled so high with junk that it is impossible to get into certain rooms. While this makes for highly entertaining television, this is not some mythological thing. Hoarding is a real and very common problem for people all around the world. When these hoarders need to move or they pass away, the junk they leave behind can be a major roadblock for casual buyers. However, when I see junk, I don't see a problem. I see opportunity. I might be able to get an incredible deal on the property because no one else wants to handle the problem. I can simply hire someone to come clean it out 100%, bring it to a point where I can put a new carpet, perhaps paint it, and get it rented out for incredible cash flow. Now, we just looked at 8 problems that I like to find in a potential rental property. Now, I want to share 3 problems I don't want to see when I'm shopping for a deal. 3 problems I avoid when shopping for a rental property. The following are 3 problems I try to avoid when I look for a rental property. This isn't to say I'll never touch a property that has one of these issues, but there better be a really good reason for it, and I would have to factor it into my numbers, of course. Number 1, neighborhood. You can't easily fix a neighborhood. Sure, you could join the local city council or start a neighborhood watch, but the neighborhood is not likely going to change because you want it to. Therefore, I don't want to buy a property where the neighborhood will always be an unsolvable problem. The property will continually be difficult to rent, the tenants will continually trash the house, and I'll continually have to deal with evictions and late rent, and in the end, the property's value will probably never increase, and it might actually decrease. Of course, I'm not saying I'm only going to buy in a Class A neighborhood, but I'm definitely not going to buy in a Class D area. Number two, foundation issues. Foundation issues scare me because they can be a huge money pit to fix, and the cost of solution can sometimes eclipse six figures. This is especially true with foundation issues on a house with a basement or a slab. I would also put any property that has water leaking in the foundation as a problem category to steer clear from. Yeah, there are investors who specialize in properties that have bad foundations, but for me, the risk is just too great. Number three, shared driveways. I once bought a nice house in a nice area that shared a driveway with the neighbor's house. Literally, the two houses were 20 feet apart with the driveway in between, split evenly down the middle, and their side and my side were separate. When I bought my house, I didn't see any issue with the situation, but within a few months, I learned a terrible truth. The neighbor was a driveway hoarder. He started to pile up garbage, boats, engines, tires, and everything else you could imagine in the driveway. Although he was polite enough to keep his junk on his side of the shared driveway, it made my property look incredibly bad, and we had a terrible time trying to rent it and then later sell it. The junk of the neighbor's driveway reduced the value of my property by 20%, and there was nothing I could do about it. Now, I don't buy properties anymore where the neighbor could so easily affect my bottom line. In addition to these three, there are other location-specific problems like being directly below a flight path or next door to a loud, angry dog. Likely, you'll have your own list of won't-touch property features, and that's okay. Success is found more often in what you say no to than what you say yes to. You don't need to try to fix every deal you find. As the saying goes, one man's junk is another man's treasure. Wrapping it up. There is no set rules as to what makes a perfect rental property. Instead, the perfect rental property is one that helps you achieve your goals, period. Buying the wrong deal will take you further from those goals. This chapter wasn't designed to give you a list of exactly what you should and should not buy, but I hope that the principles I covered will help you narrow your buying criteria down so you can focus on hunting for only the best properties and avoid potential mistakes. As you begin to search for deals, a funny thing will happen. You'll likely find potential deals. This can be a little scary for new investors because it then becomes time to start interacting with, gasp, other people. In the next chapter, I will cover the process of making an offer and negotiating your way into your dream rental property. Chapter 11, Submitting Your Offer. I wanna make you smile whenever you're sad and carry you around when your arthritis is bad. 'Cause all I wanna do is grow old with you. Adam Sandler in The Wedding Singer. My palms were sweaty and I could barely hold the guitar pick in my right hand. I just traveled 2,000 miles for this moment by plane, three buses, and two hitched rides. The noise of the waves crashing on the sand and the crackling fire near my feet helped calm my nerves on this foggy October afternoon. All I could do now, though, was wait for her to come to me. I finally spotted her a half mile down the beach, walking with her friends toward me, completely unaware of my presence on the beach and even in this part of the country. Her beauty was breathtaking, even from this distance. It had been several months since we had last seen each other, and it took everything in me not to run down the beach towards her and throw my arms around her small frame. When she finally approached, it took her a moment to realize who I was. The surprise was worth every second of the journey. Her friends, who had been in on the ruse, left us there alone to watch the fire and the waves. We talked about my internship on a U.S. Senate race that I had just quit to come see her. We talked about my morning stranded in downtown Tacoma, Washington, when the bus I was hoping to take didn't come. We talked about how much we missed each other. And then, Adam Sandler helped me win my bride. I reached over and picked up an old acoustic guitar I'd brought and struggled through a version of Adam Sandler's classic song from the 1998 movie The Wedding Singer, titled Grow Old With You. As I closed out the song, my sweaty fingers accidentally dropped the guitar pick into the hole in the front of the acoustic guitar. I tipped the guitar upside down, but instead of the pick falling out, a small gold wedding ring came out and landed on the sand. I picked it up, set down the guitar, and dropped to one knee. She said yes. Making an offer of marriage is scary stuff. You never know, with 100% confidence, what the other person will say. But if you don't stick your neck out there and make the offer, you'll never experience the incredible joy of hearing that yes and spending a lifetime together. Imagine if I had never worked the courage to ask Heather to marry me. Imagine if I had stayed at that internship where life was safe. The thought is too tragic for me to even consider. In a similar, yet much smaller way, making an offer on a piece of real estate is also scary. As with marriage, you never know exactly what you're going to get yourself into. There is risk. There is danger. But without the offer, you'll never experience the life that comes after. You'll never hear yes without the request. My goal in this chapter is to help you overcome the fear and complexity surrounding making an offer on your future rental property. I will give you the tools, tips, and process you need to not only present your offer, but also get that same positive response I heard on that beach almost a decade ago. Yes. How to make an offer. Everything in this book up into this chapter has walked you through the dating phase of your relationship with real estate. You've explored, learned, grown, but now it's time to take action and move your relationship to a new level. It's time to quit thinking, planning, and talking. It's time to start doing. As with a marriage proposal, making an offer to buy a piece of property can be overwhelming, but most of that is mental. In reality, making an offer is a pretty easy task if you've done the rest of your homework up to that point. You've committed to doing this, made a plan, done your homework, and now you are ready to offer. Now is not the time to be timid. All the planning, all the analyzing, all the mindset changes you go through, they don't mean anything if you don't actually get out there and make an offer. Now is the time for boldness, confidence, and paperwork. How you offer will depend on who will receive the offer. For example, buying on the MLS is going to be very different from offering a home from a motivated seller. I'll talk about both briefly. Offering on a property on the MLS. When you want to offer on a property currently listed on the MLS, you need to go through a real estate agent. Typically, one agent will represent the seller and the other will represent the buyer. But the seller will pay the commission for both agents. In other words, a real estate agent is typically free for the buyer, for you. Therefore, your first step in offering on a deal in the MLS is to find a real estate agent to work with. Yes, you can use the same agent who is selling the property, at least in most states. In fact, some investors like to work this way because the agent is incentivized to encourage their client to take your offer because they would make double the commission. The downside of this, however, is the inherent conflict of interest present when the listing agent, who is morally bound to get the seller the highest price possible, is also working for you. Some states, in fact, make this practice illegal as a result. I recommend using the same agent, known as dual agency, only if you are an experienced investor and don't need any advice from the agent. And of course, if it's legal in your area. Once you have your agent, offering on a property can be a quick process. The agent will walk you through each step using the form supplied by the local MLS. You'll need to check the boxes, sign on the right lines, and send the offer off with your agent to deliver, electronically most likely, to the seller. Most agents can do the entire offer process online, but I'd actually recommend sitting down with your agent if you're just getting started with real estate and have them walk you through each step of the process, at least the first time. Once the offer has been sent off, you just need to wait for the seller to respond. Offering on a property not listed on the MLS. If you are buying a property that is not listed on the MLS, you will probably not be using a real estate agent. While this can seem intimidating, it actually happens all the time, and although an agent won't be there to hold your hand, you'll get through it just fine. Making an offer to a private seller usually begins with a verbal offer, offered in casual conversation. It's usually far less official at first, and it's usually just brought up when touring the property. When I'm trying to buy a home from a private seller, I like to start by asking the seller how much they would like to get. Then, after some negotiation, which we'll cover later in the chapter, you'll come to an agreement on that price. At that point, you can pull out your official purchase and sale document and sign all the necessary places to make it official. Another casual way to make an offer without being too official is by using a letter of intent. A letter of intent is a simple document that lists the conditions of the purchase and sale, usually on one page, and doesn't use all the legalese. It's not a legal document, just a way for both parties to see a summary of what is being offered. Often, the official purchase and sale document can be dozens of pages long just to explain a few important facts. A letter of intent simply places those facts on one page so both parties can decide whether an official purchase and sale is worth drafting. If you don't have a purchase and sale, a P&S agreement lying around, don't worry. There are several places you can go to get one. First, a local title company. Title companies will often give away legal P&S agreements because they know that by providing this free form, you'll likely end up using them for the sale closing.
Online.
There are several online websites that offer state-specific legal forms for purchases. You can also check out the BiggerPockets file place at biggerpockets.com/files for other useful forms and documents. Office supply stores. Many office supply stores, especially the big box stores, carry purchase and sale agreements along with many other legal forms. Other investors. Ask around at your local real estate club to see if anyone has the form you need. Most investors would have no problem sharing theirs. Finally, no matter how you obtain your purchase and sale form, I recommend that you have a local attorney take a look at it. You want to be sure that you are covering all the necessary bases, and a lawyer can help you do that. You can also simply get a purchase and sale agreement from an attorney, though this might be the most expensive option, but doesn't hurt to ask. The earnest money deposit. The earnest money deposit, also known as a good faith deposit or simply earnest money, is money provided by the buyer when an offer is submitted as a way of showing the seriousness of the offer. This deposit is essentially the buyer saying, look, I really want to buy this property and I'm putting my money where my mouth is. The earnest money is pledged, and should the buyer not fulfill his end of the contract, the seller can keep the money. Yes, you can lose your earnest money. However, there are certain conditions that allow you to go back and back out of the deal without losing it. And I'll talk about those later in this chapter. How much is the earnest money deposit? The amount of earnest money supplied depends greatly on the price of the property and the person from whom you are buying the property. For example, the earnest money on a $40,000 house will probably be far less than the earnest money on a $1 million apartment complex. Although there is no hard and fast rules that governs the amount required, most earnest money deposits tend to be 1 to 2% of the purchase price. Because the seller gets to keep the earnest money if the buyer backs out without a good legal reason, the higher the earnest money deposit, the better the chance that your offer will likely be accepted. And I'll talk more about this in a moment as well. That said, when dealing with motivated sellers, the earnest money becomes much less normal because the seller generally doesn't know or care about the amount. Some investors simply make the earnest money a dollar, and most private sellers don't even seem to notice or mind. Who holds the earnest money? The earnest money should not be given directly to the seller. Instead, the money is usually held by a third party, most likely the title company or the attorney who's handling the closing. This ensures that the rules that govern what happens to the earnest money are followed. This is most commonly done when the contract has been accepted and signed by both parties, not before. If you are working with a real estate agent, your agent will most likely tell you when and where to drop off the earnest money check. So what exactly is the earnest money used for? What ultimately happens to it? Well, there are three possible scenarios that could play out depending on how the deal is done or not done. Number one, if the sale goes through, the earnest money becomes part of the cash the buyer have been required to bring to closing. For example, if your down payment plus closing costs came to $50,000, but you gave a $2,000 earnest money deposit, then you would only be required to bring $48,000 to the closing table, as directed by the title company or the attorney who closes the sale. Number two, if the sale does not go through and the buyer does not have a legal reason to back out, then the deposit is forfeited to the seller, and the seller receives a deposit. Number three, if the sale does not go through and the buyer does have a legal reason to back out, the deposit is returned to the buyer. So what are these legal reasons I've mentioned? Most contracts, real estate or otherwise, contain certain provisions that outline conditions in which the contract could be terminated. These provisions are known as contingencies. In other words, the property sale is contingent on some specifically listed things. These are legal loopholes that allow you to not follow through on your contract should one of these contingencies happen to occur. Technically, you could have contingencies for anything you can think of. Yes, that means you could actually write up a contingency in the contract that says, this contract is contingent on the grass being colored purple, or this contract is contingent on my hair falling out before closing. If you were to include those, and the grass was not colored purple, or your hair did not fall out, well, you could cancel the contract and back out with no repercussions. Of course, these are absurd examples meant only to illustrate what a contingency is. Don't really do that. So, what kind of contingencies should you put in your offer? First, understand that the more contingencies you put in your offer, the more leery a seller is going to be to accept it. Think about it. If someone offered to buy your home, but only if 50 little contingencies happened, Would you feel comfortable accepting it? Well, probably not. However, at the same time, contingencies are often necessary to protect yourself from things that you couldn't anticipate. Like knowing how much to offer, knowing which contingencies to include in the contract depend on the deal itself, and the person you are submitting the offer to. If I was competing with numerous other people for a property, I might include far fewer contingencies than I would if I were offering on a deal with no competition. But let me share the two most common contingencies you'll likely encounter. Number one, the inspection. You can only learn so much about a property by walking through it on a quick tour. As I'll talk about more later in the book, it is pretty important to do a deep inspection of a property before buying it, using a professional inspector to find every imperfection they can about the property. An inspection contingency, therefore, gives you the ability to inspect everything about the property within a certain time frame and back out if you find something that you didn't expect. On residential homes, a 10-day inspection contingency is most common. This means that after 10 days, the contingency is no longer applicable. Inspection contingencies are very common in real estate contracts, but some experienced investors do choose to waive the contingency, opting instead to take the risk that nothing unforeseen will come up in the inspection. If it does, and they do have to back out because of it, they could lose their earnest money. Other investors, including myself, often designate much shorter inspection periods, often as brief as 2 or 3 days, knowing that this will still allow time to get in there, get the property looked at in some detail, but it'll look better than those who need 10 days. Of course, you need to know that you can get it inspected in this short time frame. Often, professional inspectors are booked out several days in advance and take a couple days to get the report to you. Number two, financing. What would happen if you tried to buy a property, but at the last minute you found out that your financing had completely fallen through? As disappointing as it might be, you might also lose your earnest money if you don't have the financing contingency in place. Talk about a double whammy. The financing contingency allows a buyer to back out and to keep their earnest money should the buyer not be able to obtain a loan. Of course, if you are paying cash for a house, you'll have no need for a financing contingency, and your offer will likely look much stronger to the seller. Some investors choose to avoid using the financing contingency, even if they are using a loan. This can help make their offer stand out because the seller knows that either the deal will close or they'll get the earnest money no matter what happens. Of course, if you choose to waive the financing contingency, but you still plan to use a loan, that can really increase your risk of losing the earnest money should something go wrong with your financing. What should the offer include? Every real estate offer can basically be boiled down to who, what, where, when, why, and how of the deal. Who is making the offer and to whom? What is being bought and for what amount? Where am I getting the funds, the financing? When am I planning to buy it, the closing? Why would I back out of the offer, the contingencies? And how is this all going to happen, the fine print? In essence, everything from the transaction can be summed up in this. When offering on a deal on the MLS, your agent will likely walk you through every step of the document, but if you are offering on a property directly to a seller without an agent, you're likely on your own. Therefore, let's go through the elements a bit more detail. The who, the whom are fairly obvious when you're making an offer. The what and when should be pretty clear as well. So we're going to focus on the where, the why, and the how. Where are you getting the funds? Yes, the chapter on funding your purchase comes later in the book, but let's touch on the subject now. When you submit an offer, you'll likely include what kind of financing you'll be using for the purchase. Will you be using all cash? Will you be obtaining conventional financing through a local bank? Will you be using private or hard money? Most sellers want to know this information before they allow you to tie up their property for the next month or two, only to back out at the last moment because you can't actually buy it. If you are using financing, it can help to provide a letter from the lender showing that you've already been approved for a loan, often known as a pre-approval letter. Why would you back out of the offer? In other words, as we discussed earlier in the chapter, what are the contract contingencies? Can the buyer back out if they can't obtain financing? What if they find some surprise problems during the inspection, like asbestos in the attic or plumbing that hasn't worked in a generation? What if the house appraises for far less than what was offered? Make sure your purchase and sale document spells it all out. How will this all happen? In other words, the contract should spell out the exact process by which the sale will proceed. This includes all the small print that helps the title company or attorney know exactly how to move forward with the sale. Your purchase and sale agreement should have all of this written out in it. How much should you offer? Now for the difficult question, how much should you offer? Hopefully, you did your preliminary numbers on the deal and have a decent idea of what you can pay for the property. But should you offer the exact amount? Should you lowball the seller, like offer an extremely low price hoping they take it? The truth is this, there is no one right way. Some investors choose to submit a lot of lowball offers, hoping something somewhere pans out. Others choose to give their highest and best offer up front. Still others find room somewhere in the middle. Each of these techniques have a time and place, but each individual deal will dictate the kind of offer you should submit. For example, if the home has been sitting on the market for a long time and you have a good indication that the seller is eager to sell, there is no real danger in submitting a lowball offer to see what happens. However, if you are in a competitive market and a new listing hits the MLS at a great price and you know it is going to sell quickly, you may want to cut out the chase and simply offer your highest amount right then and there. Sometimes you may even need to offer more than the asking price. The transaction for a triplex I recently purchased went exactly that way. The big, ugly purple triplex REO hit the market at $70,000, and I just knew by the photos that this thing would go fast. It needed some work, but the property was in overall great shape and would bring in almost $2,000 a month in income. Within hours of hitting the MLS, I submitted a bid of $72,000 for the property. Wanting to be the first and assuming that any other offers would probably be full priced, but I didn't think any would go over. And I was right. And today, this property is one of my highest cash flowing deals. Had I tried to lowball the seller with a $50,000 offer, they would have laughed at me and moved on to another interested party. But for me, even at $72,000, the numbers worked great. And that is the key. The numbers worked at $72,000. I would never pay more than the asking price just to win a bid if the numbers didn't pencil out, and you shouldn't either, unless you have some dramatic future reason for doing so. Another time, I walked through a home on the MLS and the seller was home, so we struck up a conversation. I talked about this earlier in the book, but she was trying to move to California and the house, which she could not take care of, was the only thing keeping her from doing so. She was eager to go be with the rest of her family and just wanted out. The seller was asking $30,000 for the piece of junk property, but because of the condition, I didn't expect any other investors to be pounding down her door. It was only a mediocre deal. I offered her $16,000 for the property and told her I could close in a couple weeks. She took it. As you can see from these two examples, I submitted an offer on both these properties the day they were listed, yet my strategy was different for each property. The motivation was different, as was the relative price. These are just a few of the nuances in the real estate game that you'll master quickly once you start making offers. Never assume that the offer price is always black and white, and keep your eyes open to the cues that will help you make a solid offer with the best chance of being a win-win for all parties involved. There is no silver bullet in knowing exactly how much you should offer. Each deal is different and requires a different analysis and strategy. Yes, this means it takes real work. However, the more offers you make, the more deals you close, and the faster you'll reach your financial destination. Just keep one eye on the financials and other on the situation, and you'll do great. 16 tips for getting your offer accepted. Making offers and getting them accepted is often as much about art as math. This section will give you 16 tips for getting your offer accepted. No one tip is applicable to every situation, but to paraphrase an analogy, the more tools you have in your tool shed, the more projects you can build. Consider each of these a tool in your shed. Number one, work fast. As they say, the early bird gets the worm. Sometimes the secret to getting a yes is as simple as being the first to offer on a property. Be sure to have automatic alerts set up with your real estate agent, so you'll instantly be notified about new properties as they hit the market. Then, don't hesitate. Run the numbers and make the offer. Don't let fear slow you down. Number two, offer your best up front. Rather than playing a game with the seller, offer your maximum offer right up front. If they counter and try to make you go higher, just say no. If the numbers work at 90, sometimes it's just best to offer 90 and not try to shoot for 85. Number three, submit a letter with your offer. When offering on a piece of property, remember that there is always a person at the other end of the line making a decision, even if it is a bank repo. So if you want to get your deal accepted, get that person to like you. I think the best way to do this is simple. Include a letter with your offer. This doesn't have to be anything formal, just a quick message letting the seller know who you are and what you plan to do with the house. I use this strategy almost every time I submit an offer, and I can promise you, it works. I also believe it is important to include a photo with the letter. This lets the seller know that you are not just some investor, you are a real person. Include your family in the photo for added benefit. Here's a letter I use in Figure 12 at biggerpockets.com/rentalbookfigures, but I'll read it here as well. Feel free to modify it and submit it with your next offer. Hello, my name is Brandon. My wife and I are real estate investors here in Grays Harbor County and have a special love for ugly properties, which attracted us to yours. We love this community and love to make old properties new again, revitalizing this area and improving the neighborhoods where we live and work. As you know, address has a few maintenance concerns, but that is our specialty. I love to put in new electrical, windows, flooring, foundation, and, you know, all the usual paint, etc. As my agent can testify to, I'm a very active buyer here in town, and I always do what I say I'm going to do. I don't put properties under contract unless I'm sure I can deliver. Hopefully, this attached offer sounds reasonable to you. I know I'm offering less than you were asking, but due to the repairs needed, these are the numbers that work for me. Either way, I wish you the best of luck. I look forward to working with you. Sincerely, Brandon and Heather Turner. Of course, my picture is there at the bottom. Number 4, discover the seller's true motivation. Always try to determine what the seller's true motivation is for selling. Are they looking for the absolute highest price? Are they in need of a fast closing? Just yesterday, I walked through a house with someone who called me after finding my I Buy Houses website. While touring the house, I learned that the home is owned by his grandmother who can no longer afford the tax or insurance payment on the home. They want to use the money to buy her new car and soon. This person's main motivation was not getting the highest price, but solving a problem quickly. Number 5, feel a little uncomfortable. A real estate agent friend of mine once told me, if I submit an offer and it doesn't make me blush, I offered too much. In other words, when you're trying to get a good deal, submitting offers should make you feel a little uncomfortable. So get out there, make some offers, blush a bit, and get a few killer good deals. Number 6, all cash helps. If you can afford to offer all cash on a property, this can help you get an offer accepted, even if other potential buyers have offered more. Sellers love cash buyers because they know the money is there and the risk that the buyer will not be able to follow through drops significantly. Number 7, remove the financing contingency. Even if you can't afford to offer all cash, you could always remove the financing contingency from the offer. Of course, if you remove the financing contingency and then you can't get a loan for the property, you could lose your earnest money deposit. That is a risk, of course, but if you are confident taking that risk, it can help grease the offer and help you get to yes. Number 8, waive the inspection contingency. Most sellers know their properties need a lot of work. Therefore, sellers get nervous when people want to do an inspection on the property. They fear that they will accept an offer and then a week later, the buyer will back out because they discovered how bad the property really is. Therefore, if you want to dramatically increase your chance of getting an offer accepted, don't include an inspection contingency. Again, that will increase your risk because if you learn something about the condition that you did not expect, you can't back out without losing your earnest money deposit. However, removing the inspection contingency can be a powerful way to make your offer stand out. Number 9, close faster. Once a seller decides to sell their property, they can't wait to get that burden off their shoulders. Make your offer stand out by offering a shorter, sooner closing date. Of course, if you are using a bank loan, you might not have much of a choice. Banks usually take 30 to 45 days to get all the paperwork to buy a property. But if you are using cash, private, or hard money, set a quick closing date. Number 10. Give 2 offers. When you submit an offer on a property, the seller will compare what you offered with what they are asking. If you offered $150,000 on a $190,000 house, they will instinctively do the math and say to themselves, wow, they are offering me $40,000 less than what I'm asking. Instead, consider submitting 2 offers on the property, so the seller compares the 2 offers rather than the asking price in your offer. Perhaps one offer could be for $150,000 cash, and the other could be $165,000 with financing that'll take 60 days to close. The seller is now trying to decide which offer is better, and they're kind of ignoring their own asking price. This price anchoring strategy is used in many different industries, but only rarely used in real estate, which is too bad because it actually works quite well. Number 11, more earnest money. Show the seller you are serious by offering a large earnest money deposit. Although 1% to 2% is customary, consider offering significantly more to show the seller